So this week the Akankeya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 6. If a bhikkhu should wish, of course bhikkhus shouldn't wish for anything, so. According to Venerable Anālayo, the particular sutta has two corresponding suttas. One of them is found in the Anguttara Nikaya, Anguttara 10s, and the Chinese parallel in the Majjhima Agama. So no other corresponding suttas for this particular one. Anguttara Nikaya 1 is a similar version to the Pali, but shorter, doesn't have so many wishes. Perhaps it's when we see similar discourses found in the Pali canon, then we can, you know, ask God what's the relationship between them. In some cases, it might be that the Buddha simply taught similar discourses on different occasions, and so that's a good enough reason to collect both of them. In other cases, that there might be just one discourse which is actually artificially replicated across more than one collection for one reason or another. And so that it might be chopped down to fit into the Anguttara Nikaya or lengthened to fit into the Digha Nikaya or something like that. So in the case of, for example, the Satipatthana Sutta, then there seems little doubt that the Maha Satipatthana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya was lengthened in order to make it fit in the Digha. In the current case, with this particular discourse, it's not so clear cut. Perhaps it might be that there's just simply different discourses. My suspicion perhaps is the Anguttara one was chopped down from the Majjhima version, but this is just a bit of a suspicion I have. Okay, again, this is one of those suttas. This is quite a simple and direct sutta. Not much in the way of narrative background or anything like that. The commentary tells a bit of a story about a monk who went and sat down under a tree, and they was sitting so still under the tree that the tree deva decided to test him by shaking the roots of the tree around and see what would happen. But no matter how much they shook the roots of the tree, they couldn't disturb the monk because they were in such deep meditation. So this is, according to the commentary, perhaps one of the reasons why the sutta was spoken. In the Majjhima Agama version, Chinese version, one slight difference is there that rather than the sutta just starting out with the straight teaching, in the Chinese version, a certain monk who's unnamed comes to visit the Buddha and reports a reflection that he had while in seclusion. And his thought was that thanks to the Buddha having taught him the Dhamma, he was living endowed with the moral precepts, staying in an empty and secluded place, not neglecting jhana and engaging in insight meditation and vipassana. And this reflection of the monk led the Buddha to deliver the present discourse. Okay, so that's what I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove in Atapimdika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus dwell possessed of virtue, possessed of the Padimokkha, restrained with the restraint of the Padimokkha, perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest fault, trained by undertaking the training precepts." So this is, in the Pali version, is like a guiding verse or passage, which is sort of setting the tone for the whole sutta, and we should see this paragraph as being central to the purpose of the sutta. As the commentary says, this particular sutta is a discourse on the benefits of sila, on the benefits of virtue. Okay, so the commentary says this whole sutta is a discourse on the benefits of virtue. Is that right?
Yes.
No, I haven't heard it yet.
Keep the precepts.
I didn't do my homework.
That's why he's sitting at the back of the class. Yeah. And the bad boy is sitting there.
I'm ready.
Any thoughts on that?
Benefits of keeping the precepts.
Yeah.
Well, good. It's rare.
It's rare, but is that really what the discourse is about?
I didn't
say that first one. Venerable Tapasi would like to say something, but he's aware that I'm setting up a trap here.
Not
And so he's too cautious to actually open his mouth, you see. So this is the wisdom that comes from living with Sujato for a long time. You're able to tell when he's asking a trick question, because the Chinese version doesn't have that paragraph. So we begin to suspect a conspiracy that not only is this paragraph found in the Pali version and not in the Chinese version, but the commentary, in fact, says this verse, which is placed in such a prominent position right at the start of the sutta. The commentary says this captures the essence of the whole thing. And we should think of the whole discourse as being a discourse whose basic theme is the benefits of sila. And according to Venerable Nalio's comment here, this commentarial presentation seems to be a nuance too narrow. Even though a sound foundation in moral conduct is certainly an indispensable requirement for a monk's training and therewith for all the various benefits mentioned, what the Akankeya Sutta seems to be about, rather, is the need to progress from a sound foundation in moral conduct to developing tranquility and insight, for which purpose one should dwell in seclusion. Thus, the Pali commentary and, to some extent, even the two Pali discourses betray a slight tendency to overrate the strict observance of the rules, a tendency not uncommon among the orthodox followers of the southern tradition.
A little vehicle.
So what do you think? Is that right? Or
the Pali?
Yeah. So anyway, this is this little difference here. So you can interpret it as you like. Just to scotch any possible doubts about this, of course, that passage on the benefits of the Paṭimokkha and keeping sila, of course, is found in Chinese in many other places. It's not that it's just invented in the Pali. Of course, it's found in many other places, but not in this particular place. But it is interesting to look at that. I mean, the fact that that passage is there or not there actually doesn't change the content of the sutta, really. It does change a bit the perspective. But what's interesting, I find, is that it's that very passage which we might want to have doubts about, which is the one which the commentary picks up and then says this is the essence of the sutta, the most important part of the sutta. Yeah? And so that's how we see that these shift in emphasis, which starts out as a very small difference, and then becomes something quite big, quite important. Okay. So then we go on to the wishes that the bhikkhu should wish. So he's not quite saying that a bhikkhu should wish these things. He's just saying if a bhikkhu should wish, may.
That's a whole string of wishes.
Yeah.
None of which is related to anything that is being suggested after the string of wishes. It sort of says you can have a whole string of wishes.
This is what you got to do. No? Sorry about that noise, everybody. It must be the Sri Lankan currents. Okay. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I be dear and agreeable to my companions in the holy life, respected and esteemed by them. Let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight, and dwell in empty huts. So do you think that's a very good motivation for one to wish to do all those things? So any other opinions? Karen has said no?
Well, the Buddha talked a lot about if the noble ones, that you should have behavior worthy of the noble ones.
Right. Eva, sorry.
I think you should do the precepts for the love of doing the precepts.
Mm-hmm. Not because you want people to like you for it?
Well, then it's just showing off, isn't it?
It's just showing off.
If you're only doing the precepts just to get people to respect...
No, but it's... Oh,
yeah.
No, I see.
Then it's only a show. It's not...
Pat? What do you think?
Well, I didn't read it, and so I'm just not picking it up, like you're really...
Paragraph number three. So the next motivation, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I be one to obtain robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites. So if a bhikkhu should be thinking, may I get lots of requisites, therefore he should do his meditation properly and keep his precepts.
Yeah, but then he's only practicing out of greed because he wants something.
Well, no.
He wants roads, he wants food, he wants... If we practice to get enlightenment, you don't practice to get requisites.
Don't forget, we just...
I think
that's the cat and the mouse thing, because I think that if you are a bhikkhu, then I presume that you're going to practice whatever the monastery wants you to practice. So, to me, if I had whatever that practice may be, if you are given the precepts and you're living by them, I think you have to.
I don't agree with you. But, yeah. I mean, what this could be saying is that if you, I mean, you're getting requisites because you're supposed to be practicing, and if you're not doing the bhikkhu life in the right way that the Buddha taught, then you shouldn't be getting help to live. You should go out and work and just rob. So it could mean that.
And I always have a problem with this may I in all the time. But if you're saying may I get robes and food and everything else that I want and a great resting place. And to get that, I'll practice to make out that I'm doing all that. You know, that's two different things. But if they're saying, I really want to practice, and then, you know, to me, I would say, I know if I'm practicing the precepts properly, then those things would be...
But that's a different thing. The text is clearly saying that this is your motivation. The motivation is, this is what I want to get. I want to get the robes and requisites, and then that's why I want to practice. That's the motivation.
Yeah.
Do you think that? But the text is saying that?
Yes, clearly, yes. If a bhikkhu should wish. That's the implication of the text for sure.
But then he's practicing out of desire. To get something, a material benefit.
Out of desire to get material benefit.
Robes and food and shelter.
Should be
practicing for the deathless.
If you wanted to...
Should be practicing for the deathless. Yo!
Yeah.
If you wanted to... if you wanted to get these things, you'd have to have jhana possessive insight and dwelling empty dwellings.
Mm-hmm.
So you already have to have jhana and possessive insight.
Mm-hmm.
So if you depends how you interpret that and what level of
is that insight. Like or after?
That's just
this isn't that paragraph.
Where's that bit?
Because it's a three dots at the end. That means that the part that's in the paragraph before gets repeated, but it's not repeated so that you don't read it over and over again.
Uh-huh.
That's just the way Bhikkhu Bodhi's done it. Also, we did see good. We did the Dhammadhyaya Sutta before, so we can use that as a reference to what we should be doing with requisites.
Do you think it might be worthwhile checking what the Chinese version has to say on the matter?
We're obviously trying to make it right.
Can you sure?
It's a whole string of wishes. There's one wish after another after another wish. And I see it as this incredible disjoint between the whole string of wishes and the tag at the end. The tag at the end remains constant as an idea, no matter what the wishes are. So that the wishes or series of wishes to me, put into a situation where it doesn't matter about the wishes. It's a waste of time doing the wishing. This is the stuff.
Boom.
The end of the thing.
Well, maybe it's just that you need this as a foundation. Irrelevant. You know that people, when they give you the requisites, will get benefit from it and merit from it. Your field of merit for the world. Then you need to have good precepts.
Smelly herring it is. Seriously, smelly herrings. Mental traps.
You're returning practice in the precepts so you can practice get samadhi.
Yeah.
only part of the step.
Again, I just repeat the little hint. Yeah, no, do you think it might be worth checking what the Chinese has to say? Thank you very much, Pam. That's a very good idea. Actually, the Chinese doesn't have those two paragraphs. So the initial two paragraphs, which refer to purely worldly benefits to be gained from practice, then they becoming liked and esteemed and also getting the four requisites, these two paragraphs are not found in the Chinese version of this sutta.
And it is shorter, is it? Did you not say?
The Chinese...
By that much or by other?
I think... No, there's also a couple of others which I'll mention in a minute are found in the Chinese but not in the Pali. So there's a few missing or added in both of them, yeah? But those two ones only found in the Pali. So what does that tell us?
What's happening with the happy hour at the
time? Perhaps it tells us about the motivations of the bhikkhus who were redacting this particular text. Interesting, isn't it? So, and it's interesting, all the rest of them are spiritual benefits and not kind of worldly benefits in the same way. So, casting to the first one of these spiritual benefits, when my kinsmen and relatives who have passed away and died remember me with confidence in their minds. Oh, sorry. May the services of those whose robes, arms, food, resting place and medicinal requisites I use bring them great fruit and benefit. Let him fulfill the precepts. Let him be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight and dwell in empty huts. So this possibly we might think is really should be the first of the benefits. And notice it would be very easy to skip from here to the one, should I be one who gets the requisites? Here it's still talking about the requisites, but it's not actually saying I want to get the requisites. It's saying that for those people who offer the requisites, so may that be very fruitful for them. Yeah, through I'm going to purify my practice, not because I want to get requisites, but because of my gratitude for getting the requisites, and I want that the people who offer them to get very good results from their offering by my purity of my practice. Yeah, so that's a much more worthy and a spiritual goal. So just to have a look at the actual things that the bhikkhu is supposed to do here. And of course, bhikkhunis as well. Let him fulfill the precepts. Okay, so this is the sila. And, you know, sila, of course, having a broader connotation than just the precepts and the whole kind of way of practice of body and speech being included here under sila, including our livelihood. Our practice of restraint and contentment, the doing of duties and so on in the monastery, the way that we speak and communicate with others, development of harmony in the community, and all of these kinds of things are all part of this thing here saying fulfilling the precepts. So it's not simply a negative thing where we have to sort of just not break any precepts and that's enough. That's not enough to be able to be sampanno, to fulfilled or consummate in the sila. So it's a bit hard to translate there.
And then with this translation, there's not neglecting meditation. What's the word here for meditation?
I come to that in a minute. Okay. Yeah, maybe it's just one at a time. Okay, so the next one is be devoted to internal serenity, samatha of mind. So this is what one should do. Obviously, this Obviously, it was a textual error, because obviously the Buddha didn't teach samatha meditation, because you just get attached to it. You're going to, obviously this was obviously just a mistake. What it said was, should have said was, avoid at all costs internal serenity of mind. So bhikkhus should be scared and afraid of peace and happiness of mind and run away very quickly whenever it happens.
Get back into pain.
Yeah, pain and noting and body sweeping and forcing yourself to sit through. Strange, isn't it? Yes.
Obviously something that crept in there.
Yeah, it's obviously a later interpolation. Kind of Hindu thing. Anyway, funnily enough, devoted to internal serenity of mind, ajatang cheto samatana yuto, not neglect meditation. Of course, when we read meditation, as Venerable Tapasi was hinting earlier, we tend to think of it in a very general, very vague way. But of course, the word isn't, there's no Pali word for meditation. Okay, so there's no one word in Pali which encompasses what we call meditation. If there was to be a word, probably bhavana would be the closest. But the word here is jhana. So it says not neglect jhana. And so it's a bit unfortunate here that Bhikkhu Bodhi's chosen to translate jhana as meditation, and I think it's clearly far too broad and has quite a wrong connotation. It's not merely broad, it's actually quite inaccurate. I mean, when we talk about meditation, what we actually mean is that process by which we're kind of developing our mind, you know, which is more like the bhavana, chitta bhavana, whereas when we talk about jhana, of course, it's talking about the actual state of consciousness, which is the result of that process. Yeah. So in a sense, you know, we think of the samatha, the internal serenity of mind, as being in a way like the process of calming the mind, yeah? What we're doing to actually make ourselves peaceful and so on. And the jhana is the actual particular state of purified consciousness which results from that.
Would absorption be a better word?
Yeah, absorption is probably better. Yeah, they usually use that for apanna, but that apanna is a purely commentarial term, meaning jhana, but... Yeah, absorption is... But, I mean, you know, even when Yanomoli translated the Visuddhimagga, I mean, that was in about 1950, he already left jhana untranslated and absorbed it as an English word. So I don't see any reason why we shouldn't do that.
So this is where the Thai masters get this word apana, they say.
Yeah, apana is from the threefold samadhi, tanaka samadhi, momentary concentration, upachara samadhi, access concentration, and apanna, absorption.
So they mean jhana when they say
apanna. They mean jhana when they say apanna, yeah. Yeah. Alright. Not neglect jhana, be possessed of insight is vipassana, of course. And to dwell in empty huts. So it's interesting that it starts out with something quite basic, like the precepts, and then goes up to quite advanced things, vipassana and jhanas, and then goes back to what appears to be quite basic things again, dwelling in empty huts. Perhaps dwelling in empty huts is more subtle than we might think. Yeah. Sorry. Well, it's actually sunyagara, the word being gara being equivalent to the English garage. So perhaps this is like garage dhamma or something like that.
My garage is full, not empty.
Is it? Yeah. Well, see, this is the thing. It's really a comment on the propensity of the Australian male to fill up their garage full of junk and to spend all their day there. Yeah. This is really, it's endorsing the lifestyle of the Australian male. But
you empty his garage.
Yeah.
Get enlightenment.
Yeah. So sunyagara has two connotations, one being an empty dwelling or an empty place to stay, and the other one being a dwelling in emptiness. So in the Parajika rule, you can actually commit a Parajika offence for claiming supernormal attainments if you say I delight in an empty dwelling. Yeah.
So basically what it's saying.
Yeah, if you have that implication, if you're just saying I like living in a quiet place, and that doesn't count. But if you're deliberately hinting, it's, oh yes, I delight in an empty dwelling.
Could that also someday mean like an empty dwelling is the body or the mind? I mean, as a body, as you're dwelling in the body, but it's empty.
I think everything.
Everything.
I think it means everything. Yeah.
So, Dara here means the house, so it also means house, is that right? So, when yeah. someone goes off in the home life, is.
Agarasna, anagarion, yeah. Anagarika, yeah. It means not living in a garage. That's right.
To the garden shed.
Right. So, if a bhikkhu should wish, when my kinsmen and relatives who have passed away and died remember me with confidence in their minds, may that bring them great fruit and great benefit. When my kinsmen and relatives who have passed away and died remember me with confidence in their minds.
How would they do that? Unless they're hanging around as hungry ghosts or something.
Yeah, maybe they are.
Yeah. What if they passed away but didn't die?
They passed away but didn't die? This is a tautology. Oh, it is, yeah. Yeah, it's just a replication. But it seems to mean it's like the hungry ghost or something like that. And so when you kind of do the food offering and maybe if there's hungry ghosts around and so on, and then they think, oh, you know, my son or my friend or something like that is practicing well and living the good life, so thus he won't be reborn as a hungry ghost like me. Then they have great confidence. And so it's understood that this is way that they make merit. Yeah, they can have mudita. And if you're in that hungry ghost realm, you can actually have a wholesome mind state by doing this.
Also, it's interesting, I think it's one step in the Anguttara Nikaya that talks about can offerings benefit other people if you make an offering?
Mm-hmm.
So you make an offering for someone who's passed away, and for each case it's no, and only for the hungry ghost
mm-hmm.
that is the case that someone can actually benefit from okay. the offering that you make.
Okay. Yep, that's good. Okay, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I become a conqueror of discontent and delight, and may discontent and delight not conquer me. May I abide transcending discontent and delight whenever they arise. Does anything strike you as being odd about that particular passage?
If he's not saying discontent and delight, he's saying, may I be the conqueror of discontent and delight, and may discontent not conquer me, and may I by transcending discontent. But he doesn't say any delight.
Oh, okay, so mine does.
Oh! Oh, are you reading the Chinese one?
No, I'm reading this one. I'm reading Bhikkhu Bodhi's one.
Yeah, but that's weird.
Ah!
This one also says,
what have you got?
This one says, my kingdom.
He's got an empty dwelling. It's only got delight once, and the rest of the content has discontent. That's the latest version. Maybe this is an old version. So have we been changed? This is the 1995 edition. The original version. Have we been changing the Pali canon since 1995? 2,500 years it's supposed to have survived without a single change, and now since 1995.
This is how Mahayana developed.
This is how Mahayana developed, yeah.
Delight is okay. Maybe sometimes he uses different sources, so maybe he checked one source and preferred the other, and then he's preferred another source.
Yeah, apparently, his Venerable Ananda's little note on this. From the viewpoint of textual transmission, it might be of interest that the Chinese version in the Majjhima Agama has a... Oh, sorry. Oops. Oops. Wrong footnote. That's the next one. In relation to discontent, it is a little curious that the Pali version, Madhyama version, first speaks of discontent and delight, that's arati rati, but then continues to treat only discontent. So what seems to happen, perhaps it looks like Bhikkhu Bodhi, perhaps following Yanamoli, has put discontent and delight. Perhaps he just didn't notice that little change in the text and made that as just a mistake in his first edition and then corrected it in subsequent editions. I think that seems the likely thing. So then the problem remains, why does the Pali have that change? Why does it mention discontent and delight in the first one and then just discontent later on? The corresponding passage in the Anguttara Nikaya also has discontent and delight, has both of them, but that has a variant reading which only mentions discontent. And the Chinese version also speaks only of discontent, thereby supporting the variant reading found in the Anguttara Nikaya, which also would seem to fit better with the contexts. So perhaps we might consider the possibility that the original reading just said, may I be conqueror of discontent, and that the delight thing has just slipped in there by accident. Maybe best by a careless writer, just writing the scroll, just accidentally wrote down the word rati. It's only four letters. If you write an extra four letters, just repeating it twice, as it's very easy to do in your writing, and it slips in there. And then probably then the commentator found great reasons to explain why that was there or something like that. So most likely it just said discontent. And in this kind of context, discontent usually means, arati means, yeah, but it means more specifically not wanting to be a monk anymore. Yeah, just having like lack of inspiration in leading the holy life and in doing spiritual practice. So basically you just don't want to do it anymore. That's more specifically what it means. So the next one, may I become a conqueror of fear and dread, and may fear and dread not conquer me. May I abide transcending fear and dread whenever they arise. So here, of course, recapitulating the theme that we discussed a few weeks ago in the Fear and Dread Sutta. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I become one to obtain at will, without trouble or difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide a pleasant abiding here and now, let him fulfill the precepts. So, moving, of course, as is very typical in the suttas, from the simpler dhammas up to the more exalted principles. And if a bhikkhu should wish, may I contact with the body and abide in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, arupa, transcending forms, let him fulfill the precepts. So this also is a slightly unusual phrase, one would think, isn't it? You're touching, there's supposed to be formless attainments, there's no form there, there's nothing material, and yet one's touching it with the body. What's going on here?
Bhikkhu Bodhi explains,
does he? What does he say?
He's trying to explain, but this is that basically your experience is like when you experience something, you experience it with your like whole body or something. So can you understand that? No, from his talk.
In his talk, he says, yeah.
So when you experience something, say for instance some kind of peace or something, then you experience it with your whole body in the same way you experience it with your whole body.
But that's still physical, isn't it?
Not as means in a. It's not a literal sense, not meaning the body.
Not a literal body.
As an experience, not as you experience it in the body.
Uh-huh.
But as an experience, when you experience something, you usually feel it in the body.
Yeah. In the commentary glosses body here as namakaya, which is problematic, or probably a bit overly literal. Namakaya is a technical term which is, I think, in the suttas only found in the Mahanidana Sutta and one or two other places. And the Namakaya just means the body or the group of conceptual naming aspects of the mind. and probably doesn't really have anything to do with this particular context. But I think Bhikkhu Bodhi's explanation, as Venerable Tipassi said, is quite correct, that these kind of contexts, the word kaya or body, has this meaning, has a much more of an abstract meaning of almost like to personally experience something, yeah? And so the emphasis is not on the physicality of it, the emphasis is on the immediacy and the fact that one is actually plunging in and experiencing that thing oneself. And that's really like the connotation of the use of the word kaya in these kinds of contexts. So, you know, in later Buddhism, of course, in the Mahayana, of course, you have lots of different kinds of kaya, dharmakaya and so on. And, you know, that you can see how these later uses would have derived from or sort of find their impetus in these kinds of usage, which is using kaya in a very abstract way. So, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the destruction of three fetters, become a stream enterer no longer subject to perdition, bound for deliverance, headed for enlightenment, or destined for enlightenment, let him fulfill the precepts. So, what are the three fetters?
Greed, hatred, and delusion.
Personality, and appearance.
Oh, those three fetters.
Yeah.
Self-view.
What were they again, Eva? If you could repeat them.
Personality, view,
mm-hmm.
doubt,
mm-hmm.
and adherence to rules and observances.
Adherence to rules and observances. Okay, so is that what it means? Because the word Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as rules, is sila. So does that mean adherence to sila is one of the fetters we have to overcome?
I would say the translation better way would be misapprehension of rules and observances.
Yeah.
Of value.
Yeah?
Also heard rites and rituals.
Rites and rituals is a very common rendering. It doesn't really mean rites and rituals, though. It's kind of a catchy phrase. But the Pali word is sila bhata. Sila meaning sila. Bhata is literally a vow. So things like, say, the dog duty ascetic. Yeah, with dog vow ascetic, where you take a vow, I'm going to live like a dog. That's that kind of vow. Yeah, or I'm going to vow to be a Buddha in my future life or something like that. Is that what it means? If I vow to be a Buddha in my future life, is this one of the fetters?
As if you became a stream enterer.
You know, if I became a stream enterer, I wouldn't be able to do it, would I?
Yeah, but does that mean a stream enterer doesn't have to keep the Padimokkha?
Doesn't have to keep the precepts.
Except he's not.
Well, that would be certainly convenient.
This is a bit of a Rajneeshi, this one.
And then they automatically observe the precepts. Once you're a stream enterer.
Once you're a stream enterer, you automatically observe the precepts. But if you're not adhering to this, as here, you've got rid of the adherence to the precepts.
Misgrasping.
Misapprehension.
You don't attach to the precepts as an end in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The way I understand it is that if you're attached to something believing that by doing this you'll get enlightened,
mm-hmm.
that if you have that kind of attachment, then that's the kind
that's
of
obstacle
it's talking about. Say, for instance, if you believe, oh, I'll do 10,000 prostrations and then after that I'll burn
for example.
My karma and then be enlightened, then that would be a... That would
be sila bhata paramasa, yeah. Yeah, the word paramasa literally means to touch something or to grab it, and but it has an implication of wrongly, to grab it wrongly, misgrasp or misapprehend something. And there's various contexts where that applies. The prefix para, not infrequently, has that kind of thing. You have these words like parabhava is like decline or something like that, or... just trying to think other examples, but there are some words where that prefix has that kind of implication. It's kind of an idiom in Pali. So this word is I think I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Bhikkhu Bodhi in his later renderings now uses misapprehension, maybe in the Sangyutta?
This is the latest. He also updated this one.
Paragraph 11.
This is just talking about the stream entry part, doesn't talk about the
scene. Oh, it doesn't actually mention them, yeah.
At the final scene.
Yeah. So I think he might have changed that rendering. So, next one, may with the destruction of the three fetters and with the attenuation or the lessening of greed, hatred and delusion become a once returner, returning once to this world to make an end of suffering. So which world does one return to?
This world.
Which world? What do you mean, this world?
The world of desire.
This is the Kama Loka? So does that mean you can reborn anywhere in the hell realm? No. Hungry ghost realm? No?
Lower realms, maybe.
No, you can't be born in the lower... You can't be born in the lower realms because you cut that off, so that's fair enough. But you can be born in the human realm or the Deva realm. Any of the Deva realms?
Not any.
Brahma realms?
Yeah. But that's not the Karma Loka. If you say it's the Karma Loka, it just says this world. But what does this world mean? Does it mean the Karma Loka? Does it mean Manusa Loka, the human realm? Does it mean any of the three realms?
Planet
Earth.
Sorry? The world below the
Does it mean Earth?
Formless. Below the formless.
I don't know what I mean. I'm just asking, what world does it mean?
This is one of the controversial ones, isn't it?
This is a controversial point, yeah.
Coffee table discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's translated it as this world, which in
this world
means this planet Earth.
This Earth, yeah?
That's what he's translating.
Yeah, I mean, it's Ayang Loko is the phrase. It's just literally this earth, this world. Mm. But
what does it mean?
Yeah.
No understand.
How do people at the Buddhist time understand?
Yeah, I don't know.
Look at the context that Buddha was talking.
Yeah.
I thought that I read somewhere that there was a place where once returners go.
Yeah.
But they don't have to come back to the human body, but they'll come back to like a very high deity.
That's it, the non-returners, the pure abodes, yeah?
Yes.
They go to the pure abodes.
What are we talking about?
Once returner, yeah.
Oh.
They return once to this world and then make an end of suffering. You see, we've seen with the non-returner that yes, they get reborn in the pure abodes,
uh-huh.
Usually.
Yeah.
And then get enlightened there, whereas the once returner, perhaps the implication that they might be born in a high Brahma realm or something like that, and then come again to this world, maybe the human world.
Go and come.
And then, I don't know.
I
really don't know this one, but this is a controversial question, whether it means the human realm or what realm exactly it means.
If they were to go, then they have a possibility of maintaining enlightenment there. But then it says, then return to this world and attain liberation.
Mm.
So that means that the possibility would be ruled out for them in that destination, if they were to go and then come.
Mm.
So I think it just means...
Just to be reborn again in the human realm.
Mm. Well, I don't know which realm.
I don't know which realm.
But certainly not below.
Mm.
Because even Sotapanna cannot go below human, right?
Yeah.
Because everywhere it is must be pretty good.
Yeah. We'll take it.
All right.
But I guess if you have a conversation, what this was at that time, and you say this world, well, it's this world. If we were talking, I said I'm going to come back to this world.
Mm.
If I was going to another one, I would say another one. I mean, it's just English, isn't it? This world, it's this, you're there. English.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. I think you're probably right. That's probably the most natural implication. The only problem is that the word world is also used in a broader sense. So it doesn't just mean earth, but in Pali, like the Kama Loka, for example, is another world. It's used as a very expandable concept. So this world might be the sense sphere world is the Kama Loka, which could be anywhere from the heaven realms to the, you know, so there's quite... is still counted as this world. But I think you're probably right that the most natural way to interpret it is you know, back here.
Back
yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
So
So may I, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, become due to reappear spontaneously, and it gives the addition in the pure abodes, and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. Let him fulfill the precepts and so on. So do bhikkhus ever do that? Does anybody ever wish, oh, I really want to be a once returner? Or do they say, oh, I want to be an arahant? I don't know. Anyway. If a bhikkhu should wish, may I wield the various kinds of supernormal power? Having been one, may I become many. Having been many, may I become one. May I appear and vanish. May I go unhindered through a wall, through an enclosure, go through a mountain as through space. May I dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. May I walk on water without sinking, as though it were earth. Seated, cross-legged, may I travel in space like a bird. With my hand, may I touch and stroke the moon and sun, so mighty and powerful. May I wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma realm, then let him fulfill the precepts. Can you get the seating over?
Yes.
Actually,
I think I'll get a book for that.
Thank you. So, of course, the standard passage on the various kinds of supernormal powers. May I, with the divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human, hear both kinds of sounds, the divine and the human, those that are far as well as near. May I understand the minds of other beings, of other persons, having encompassed them with my own mind. And then the different kinds of consciousness, mind affected by lust and mind unaffected by lust and so on. This is the same passage as found in the Satipatthana Sutta. If a bhikkhu should wish,
thank you.
May I recollect my many past lives. Or if a bhikkhu should wish, may I, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, see beings passing away and reappearing. And finally, may, if a bhikkhu should wish, may I, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge here and now, enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless or that are free of defilements with the ending of the defilements. Let him fulfill the precepts, be devoted to internal serenity of mind, not neglect meditation, be possessed of insight, and dwell in empty huts. So there seems to be, so of course ending up with arahantship, which is fine, it's not problematic, but it seems to be a little bit odd that we've gone from realizing the supernormal attainment, the super mundane attainments of realizing stream entry, once returner, non-returner, and then all these various kinds of psychic powers, which are never really kind of that essential to the path, and finally ending up with the ending of the defilements. So what should we do here?
I think it's been misplaced.
You think it's been misplaced?
I think that the stream, all this passage on the supernormal power should go up to the after the four jhana section.
Uh-huh.
Because that's usually how the...
And how would we test that thesis?
By looking at the gradual training.
Yeah. Yeah,
similar to the elephant's footprint.
Yeah.
Usually that's
the
way, isn't it?
Yeah, that's for sure. But is there any other way that we might use?
Check the
channels. Very good idea. Ah, excellent. Why didn't I think of that? Okay, so here, Venerable Analeo has the point here. Little footnote. From the viewpoint of textual transmission, it might be of interest that the Chinese version, Madhyama Agama, has a somewhat truncated reference. That means a partial or abbreviated reference to the destruction of the defilements in its description of the wish to gain the immaterial attainments. That is to say, when the Madhyama Agama is talking about the formless attainments, just it sort of sneaks in there of probably just a few characters which seem to refer to the ending of the defilements there. Next, but after that comes the wish to gain the supernormal powers, the divine ear, to read another's mind, recollection of past lives, the divine eye, and then again the destruction of the defilements. All of those come together as one single wish, as one group. So perhaps the mention of the truncated reference to the ending of the defilements with the formless attainments is suggesting that the insertion of the Chalabhinya, the six kinds of supernormal powers, was a later insertion added at the end. Or originally all added as one wish. Yeah? So added as, so that there's one wish. There's basically the wish that one should realize the ending of the asavas. But then that gets conflated. That's the first stage. The second stage is that ending of the asavas is conflated with the whole chalabhinya, the whole six supernormal powers, which is a very common presentation that those six are all presented together. And then finally the six are then separated out, so each one gets its own individual paragraph. So there's like three stages, which is suggested here. Then it also mentions that the other Pali version in the Anguttara Nikaya goes directly from the four jhanas to the destruction of the defilements without bringing in any of the other supernormal powers and knowledges. So the Anguttara Nikaya is very straightforward and very direct. So it does seem quite likely on that those grounds that this insertion of the six abhinya is probably a later insertion. Doesn't really seem to fit. Just add, while we're on the subject, or while we're just considering the differences here, that the parallel versions, both the Pali parallel version and the Chinese parallel version, mention a couple of things that are not found in this Majjhima Nikaya version, and they are the ability to bear with hunger, cold, and physical pain, etc., contentment with whatever one receives, which is mentioned only in the Anguttara Nikaya version, and the Majjhima Agama also mentions the ability to remain unaffected by the three types of wholesome thoughts, as well as the benefit of receiving instructions from the Buddha. So all of these little extra benefits, we noted a couple of extra benefits found only in the Majjhima Nikaya version, which were quite worldly, but these extra benefits are all quite spiritual. Instead of wishing, this Majjhima Nikaya version wishes that we should get lots of requisites, but the Anguttara version says we should wish to be content with whatever requisites one receives, which is quite a different perspective on those things.
Could you say that with that first, it kind of has a feeling to it that it's been edited and somebody's just added in bits. Mm. Oh, I should have a bit more of this than just this.
Yeah.
Well, we've left out the supernormal powers, let's cram it in here.
Yeah.
You know, and about the robes, why don't we chuck in the thing about the robes and put that in at the start? That kind of fits there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it.
Supernatural power that seems to be missing.
Which one?
I'm certain that I've seen it in that when the Buddha talks about the what an arahant can do, what a Tathagata can do, which has always surprised me that he says they're unaffected by gnats and mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems so small compared to touching the sun in the moon, but it was in there. But it doesn't seem to be in here.
Yeah, that's not in the standard passage.
Why do you think that was? Why is that there at all? I mean, it seems kind of small.
Yeah, it is. It's not mentioned as any of the, like in the Chalabhinya or six direct knowledges or something. It's mentioned. It's in various places, various suttas here and there, but not in the standard lists of the attainments of the Arahant or anything.
So you don't know where it came from.
Probably in various places. Yeah, I don't think there's just one place where it just comes from.
I mean, you think it was added on? Or?
No. I think it's probably it's quite a straightforward quality, especially if you're meditating out in the open air in India, then that's probably something you had to learn how to do.
But you have to be arahant to get that.
No.
I mean, that was the implication that I understood when he said, this is what a Tathagata can do, this is what an arahant.
You'd have to find for me the exact context that you're talking about there. Okay. I have to have a look at that. I can't remember the exact one.
Okay. Yeah. I think I have it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll look at that.
Also, I think it's quite interesting that if they did add that in, because I think a lot of people do wish for psychic power.
Yeah, sure.
Mm. So then that's why they added it in, because a lot of people do wish for psychic power.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Yep.
And when you're being annoyed by mosquitoes and gnats, you'd probably find that would be the greatest power you could have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, greater than being able to fly through the air.
You have to be in the heart to get there.
I might just take a little bit of time to talk about the supernormal powers as described in the Visuddhimagga here. So just to not to go through it in detail, but just to bring your attention to this. Of course, when the suttas present the supernormal powers, as they do very often, they don't really discuss how to get them very much. They just sort of present the thing and then say it seems to be as an outcome of jhana practice. And the Visuddhimagga, of course, develops quite a complex system which shows how to develop these. And as usual with the Visuddhimagga, one may be forgiven for thinking that not everything that it says needs to be accepted as being literally 100% truly, woolly, exactly so, and not otherwise. But there's also probably some good advice here in various ways. So I might just mention a few of the points that it talks about here. First thing is that while the suttas just say you get the jhanas and then you go and do the supernormal powers, the Visuddhimagga is much more stringent. So the Visuddhimagga says you have to get the 8 attainments, not just the 4 jhanas, and it says you have to have 14 kinds of mastery of the mind when you're developing these jhanas. And so I'll just mention these briefly here. First one is the order of the kasinas, okay? So you have to practice doing the kasinas, so that's the water kasina. And for those of you who are not familiar with kasina meditation, but kasina meditation means you have like an object or something in front of it. Anyway, kasina, as understood by the Visuddhimagga, kasina meditation means you have an object, so you might start out with an earth, so you've got a clay disc, you use that to concentrate on, and then you develop a mental image of that, and that you can gain samadhi using that mental image of the thing. So the earth, the four elements, earth, water, fire, and wind, and the four colors, which are blue, red, yellow, and white, I think. And of course these things mentioned only occasionally in the suttas, but become very central to the Visuddhimagga's presentation. So the first thing you have to do is to do the order of the kasinas. That means you have to get jhana in the earth kasina, and then the water kasina, and then all through each kasina in each order. Then you have to do it the same way, but then in the reverse order, okay? And then you have to get in forward and reverse order of the different kasinas. And then you have to do the jhanas in order. So from first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, up to the neither perception nor non-perception. Then back again, the reverse order of the jhanas, and then forward and reverse order. Okay? And then you have to do skipping alternate jhanas without skipping kasinas, okay? So then you have to get the first jhana in the earth kasina and then the third jhana in the same kasina. Okay? And then to the base of infinite space and then the base of nothingness. That's called skipping jhanas. And then you have to do the same with the water kasina. Then you have to skip alternate kasinas without skipping jhanas. So you get the first jhana in the earth kasina, and then the same jhana, first jhana in the fire kasina, and then in the blue kasina, and then the red kasina, and so on. Then you have to skip both jhanas and kasinas in the following way. Get the first jhana in the earth kasina, then the third jhana in the fire kasina, then the base of infinite space, then the base of nothingness, and so on. And keep on doing that. Then you have to the transposition of factors. You get the first jhana in the earth kasina and then the other jhanas in the same kasina, and then the first jhana in the earth kasina and the same jhana in the water kasina, and so on. This is the transposition of object, and then the transposition of object and factors takes place in the following way. He attains first jhana in the earth kasina, the second jhana in the water kasina, the third jhana in the fire kasina, the fourth jhana in the air kasina, then removes the blue kasina, which he hasn't even got, but he's removed it, and attains the base of boundless space, and then removes the yellow kasina to attain the base of infinite consciousness, removes the red kasina to attain the basis of nothingness, and then removes the white kasina to attain the base of neither perception nor non-perception. So this is the transposition of factors and object. The defining of only the jhana factors by defining the first jhana factor, the first jhana as 5-factored, second as 3-factored, third as 2-factored, and fourth, and so on and so forth, is called the definition of factors. The definition of object is by defining only the object. Some people say that one should also have the defining of factors and object. Some, Kechi is, but since that is not given in the commentaries, it is certainly not a heading in the development. So if you want to do all these things, then best you go to Burma and stay with Palk, because... Yeah, because that's the kind of thing that he's teaching there. Whether you think that that's a necessary skill to develop or whatever. And just in case you think that this is... Is this something that you should do on a weekend retreat? Now, the Kasina preliminary work is difficult for a beginner and only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. Okay? So that's just keeping the mind established on the Kasina. The arousing of the nimitta is difficult, even if you've done the preliminary work, and only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. So those who manage to do the preliminary work, only 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 can get the nimitta. To extend the nimitta when it has arisen and to reach jhana is difficult, and only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. To tame one's mind in the 14 ways is difficult. I'll bet it is. And only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. The transformation by supernormal power after having training your mind in the 14 ways is difficult, and only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it. So even after you've done all that stuff, only 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 can actually get the things. Then, rapid response after attaining transformation is difficult, and only 1 in 100 or 1,000 can do it, such as the Venerable Rakita, who, 8 years after his Upasampada, was in the midst of 30,000 bhikkhus possessing supernormal power. So even though it's so difficult to do it, here we have 30,000 of them, who had come to attend on the sickness of the elder Maharohanagutta at Terambatala. And his feet is mentioned under the earth kasina. Okay. So I'll just come chapter 4, 135. So it's been mentioned here under the earth kasina. Story. He saw a royal supanna, a Garuda bird, swooping down from the sky, intending to seize an attendant royal Naga serpent as he was getting rice gruel accepted for the elder. So the Nagas were down there serving the rice gruel for the monks, and then the Garuda was going down to swoop upon it. The elder Buddha Rakita created a rock, meanwhile, with his psychic powers, and then seizing the royal Naga by the arm, he pushed him inside it. The royal supanna gave the rock a blow and made off. The senior elder remarked, "Friends, if Rakita had not been there, we would all have been put to shame." So this was the swiftness of attaining. So according to this, it is only in Buddhas, Pacheka Buddhas, chief disciples, etc., who have vast previous endeavor behind them, that this transformation by supernormal power and other such special qualities as the discriminations the Patisambhidas are brought to success simply with the attainment of arahantship and without the progressive course of development of the kind just described. So in other words, it's saying you have to do this to get these powers. Even if you become an arahant, you don't necessarily have them, except a few of the great disciples who realize these things without actually doing special practices to get them. So he then goes on to talk about various kinds of...
Okay, yep. Interesting to multiply all those thousands.
Yeah, find out how many in Burma have.
No, but just to work out what the odds were, how many trillions, you know, in how many, one in a what, trillion.
Yeah. If you all multiplied all those things out.
Is it additive or to a power, mathematically speaking?
It would be impossible.
If some Burmese traditions take this as very literal and they follow this very literally, then how come so many people have these kinds of attainments?
How many people have them if they're supposed to be so few?
If they follow it so strictly, then how can they say that so many people have them?
Yeah, I guess, well, sometimes it's a little bit selective about which bits you follow strictly and literally and which bits you don't. Yeah, that tends to be... Maybe it's. So I'll give you a couple of examples here. Obviously, we don't want to go into all of them, but just a few examples of how they talk about developing these specific kinds of psychic powers that it talks about there. Okay? I'm just trying to find some good stories. There's plenty of good stories here.
Sinking into a rock and making it.
Okay. So there's this monk. The Tripitaka Chula Abhaya, he's mentioned a few times here, he seems to be a bit of a controversialist and he keeps on objecting to the things here, which sounds quite interesting. But here's an example Maybe just to read the first one, just to get the. There's usually more detail in the first one. It's just in which being about one becomes many. It's just a bit hard to find the actual. Okay, so talking about the appearing and disappearing. Okay, the meaning here that he causes appearance causes vanishing. Blah, blah, blah. So this possessor of supernormal power who wants to make an appearance makes darkness into light. Okay, or he makes revealed what is hidden. Or what he makes what has not come into the visual field come into the visual field. How? If he wants to make himself or another visible, even though hidden or at a distance, he emerges from the basic jhana and adverts thus, let this that is dark become light. Okay? So if you're in the cave or something like that, you come out of the jhana, and then you make the wish in your mind, that is dark become light. Or let this that is hidden be revealed. Or let this that has not come into the visual field come into the visual field. Then he does the preliminary work and resolves in the way already described. It becomes as resolved simultaneously with the resolve others then see, even when at a distance, and he himself sees too, if he wants to. But by whom was this miracle formally performed? By the Blessed One. For when the Blessed One had been invited by Chula Subhadda and was traversing the 7-league journey between Savatthi and Saketa with 500 palanquins, supplied, created by Visakhama, the heavenly Patrick, the heavenly builder, he resolved in such wise that the citizens of Saketa saw the inhabitants of Savatthi, and the citizens of Savatthi saw the inhabitants of Saketa. And then when he had lighted in the centre of the city, so that's a bit like using a kind of webcam or something like that, so the two people in either cities, they could tune into each other and see each other. Then he alighted in the center of the city, he split the earth in two and showed Avicii hell. And he split the sky in two and showed the Brahma realm. Okay? This is how it describes that. Then, when the Blessed One had performed the twin miracle, which I won't go into, but he had liberated 84,000 beings from bonds, he wondered, where did the past Buddhas go when they'd finished the twin miracle? And he saw that they'd gone to the heaven of the 33. Then he stood with one foot on the surface of the earth and placed the second on Mount Yugandhara. Then he lifted his first foot and set it on the summit of Mount Sineru. Okay? Thus performing one of the most amazing yogic feats which has ever been accomplished. Mount Sinero is supposed to be 84,000 yojanas high, which is like a million miles high or something like that. He then took up the residence for the rains there in the red marble terrace and began his exposition of the Abhidhamma, starting from the beginning to the deities, blah, 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 of the 10,000 world spheres. So these are just some of the stories about that. So a bit more useful. We'll talk about the diving in and out of the ground. One who wants to do this should attain the water casino and emerge. He should do the preliminary work determining thus, let the earth in such an area be water, and he should resolve in the way already described, simultaneously with the resolve that that much extent of earth according as determined becomes water only. There he does the diving in and out. And he does not only go diving in and out, but whatever else he wants, such as bathing, drinking, mouthwashing, washing of chattels and so on, not only water, but whatever liquid that he wants, such as ghee, oil, honey, molasses and so on, he just does the preliminary work and says, let there be so much of this and that, and there becomes as much of it as he wants. If he wants to be wetted by it, he's wetted. If he doesn't want to be wetted, that he's... it is not wetted, and it's only for him that the earth becomes water, not for anyone else. People go on it on foot and in vehicles, etc., and they do their ploughing, etc., there. But if he wishes, let the water be for them too, then it becomes water for them too. When the time determined has elapsed and the extent determined, except for the water originally present, becomes earth again. So to walk on unbroken water... Then you do the opposite trick. Then you do the earth casino, and then you determine, may the water in such an area become earth, and you resolve in such a way already described, simultaneously with the resolve the water in that place becomes earth. He then goes on that. So this is what Jesus did, presumably, if he existed. And he adopts whatever posture he wishes and whatever solid that he wants, such as gems, gold, rocks, trees, etc. He adverts to that and resolves, and it becomes as he wishes. And the same thing with flying. So to be flied, you should do the It says earth casino, which seems a bit strange, doesn't it? One would think you'd do the air casino if you were flying, but anyway. Then he wants to go cross-legged. He should do the preliminary work and determine an area the size of a seat for sitting cross-legged on and resolve in the way that already described. And but it gives a warning here. Anyone who wants to travel in space should be an obtainer of the divine eye. Okay, so don't go traveling in space because without getting the divine eye first, all right? Why? On the way there may be mountains, trees, etc. that are created by temperature, or they may be created by jealous Nagas and Suparnas. The Garudas may create them, and he may need to be able to see these. Otherwise you run into them when you're flying. So how do you get to see them? You should attain the basic jhana, emerge, and then do the preliminary work thus, let there be space and resolve. But the elder Tipitaka Chula Abhaya, who's the controversialist I mentioned before, said, friends, what is the use of attaining the attainment? It is not his mind concentrated. Hence, any area that he's resolved thus, let it be space, is space. Though he spoke thus, nevertheless, the matter should be treated as described under the miracle of going unhindered through walls. Moreover, he should be an obtainer of the divine eye for the purpose of descending in a secluded place. For, another very important point, remember, if he descends in a public space, in a bathing place, for example, or at a village gate, he is exposed to the multitude. Okay? So be very careful when you go flying around. Make sure you check out before you come down. Come down in a nice secluded place. So, and it talks about touching the sun and the moon, so mighty and powerful. It says if you want to go and touch them, he goes and touches them. If he wants to touch them sitting or lying down, touching here, sitting or lying down. So, for example, if you're, say, in bed in the morning, you can't really bother to get out of your mouth. Oh, God, do I have to just go to visit the sun again? I'll just do it while I'm lying here. Then he resolves, let them come within hand's reach. Then he either touches them as they stand within hand's reach, and when they have come by the power of the resolve, like palm fruits released from their stalk, or he does so by enlarging his hand. So there's very different ways. There's different ways of doing it. When he enlarges his hand, does he enlarge what is clung to or what is not clung to? He enlarges what is not clung to, supported by what is clung to. This is our technical Abhidhamma terminology. What is clung to and not clung to loosely means organic or inorganic. Okay, so the matter in your body is regarded as clung to matter, upadina, taken up at birth, and it's probably not a very good translation, clung to. Taken up. So he enlarges what is not taken up, supported by what is taken up. So supported by this body, he expands matter, which is not part of his body. But then the elder Tipitaka, Chula Naga, said, but friends, why does what is clung to not become small and big too? When a bhikkhu comes out through a keyhole, does not what is clung to become small? And when he makes his body big, does it not then become big, as in the case of Venerable Mahamoggallana? Now, cute, isn't it?
It's really cute.
Yeah.
But why doesn't he get burnt when he touches the sun? Does he turn himself into water?
No, he takes his kitchen mittens and...
Okay.
Which is very large.
Now, at one time it seems, Kira, when the householder, Anatta Pindika, had heard the Blessed One teaching the Dhamma, he invited him thus, with come and eat at arms at our house, together with 500 bhikkhus. Then he surveyed the 10,000-fold world system, and the royal Naga serpent called Nando Pananda came within the range of his knowledge. So those of you familiar with the chanting, we do this chant of the eight auspicious victories of the Buddha, Nando Pananda Bujigangwi Buddhang Mahidhing, and here's the story. The Blessed One considered thus, this royal Naga has come within the range of my knowledge. Does he have the potential for development? And then he saw that he had wrong view and no confidence in the three jewels. He considered thus, who is there that can cure him of his wrong view? Venerable Mahamoggallana can. So, when the night had turned to dawn, after he'd seen to the needs of the body, he addressed Ananda, saying, Ananda, tell 500 bhikkhus that the perfect one is going on a visit to the gods. It was on that day that they'd got a banqueting place ready for Nando Pananda. He was sitting on a divine couch with a divine white parasol held aloft, surrounded by the three kinds of dancers and a retinue of Nagas. So this is the Naga king, Nando Pananda, and serving the various kinds of food and drinks served up in divine vessels. And the Blessed One so acted that the royal Naga saw him as he proceeded directly above his canopy in the direction of the 33 gods. Then this evil view arose in Nandopananda, the royal Naga. There goes those bald-headed monks in and out of the realm of the 33 directly over my realm. I will not have them scattering the dirt off their feet on our heads. He got up. It's like an airspace violation. It's like what happened in Iran with the British sailors who went into the Iranian waters. He got up and went to the foot of Mount Sinero. Changing his form, he surrounded Mount Sinero 7 times with his coils. So notice this motif of this, the Naga surrounding the body 7 times. And Mount Sinero, of course, being 84,000 yojanas high, a yojana is about 10 or about 15 kilometers, so you do the maths, right? Then he spread his hood over the realm of the 33 and made everything there invisible. The Venerable Ratapala said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, before I used to stand here and I used to see Sinero and the 33 gods and the Vajrayanta Palace, which is the palace of Saka. Venerable Sir, what is the cause, what is the reason why now I cannot see any of these things?" The Buddha replied, "This royal Naga called Nandopananda is angry with us, Ratapala. He's surrounded Mount Sinero 7 times with his coils, and he stands there covering us with his raised hood and making it dark." Ratapala said, "I will tame him, Venerable Sir," but the Blessed One would not allow it. Then the Venerable Bhaddiya and the Venerable Rahula and all the bhikkhus in turn offered to do so, but the Blessed One would not allow it. Last of all, the Venerable Mahamoggallana said, "I will tame him, Venerable Sir." The Blessed One allowed it, saying, "Tame him, Moggallana." The elder abandoned that form, his physical body, and assumed the form of a huge royal Naga. And he surrounded Nandopananda 14 times with his coils and raised his hood above the other's hood and squeezed him against Mount Sinero. The royal Naga produced smoke. The Venerable said, "There's smoke, not only in your body, but also in mine." And he produced smoke. The royal Naga's body's smoke did not distress the elder, but the elder's smoke distressed the royal Naga. Then the royal Naga produced flames. And so the elder produced flames. The Naga's fire did not distress the monk, but the monk's fire distressed the Naga. The Naga thought, "He squeezed me against Sinero and he's produced both smoke and flames." Then he asked, "Sir, who are you?" "I am Moggallana, Nanda." "Venerable Sir, resume your proper bhikkhu state." The elder abandoned the form of a Naga and assumed the form of the monk. Then he went into the royal Naga's right ear and came out of his left ear. He went into his left ear and came out of his right ear. Likewise, he went into the right nostril and came out the left nostril. He went into the left nostril and came out of the right nostril. Then the Naga opened his mouth. The elder went inside, walked up and down, east and west, inside his belly. The Blessed One said, "Moggallana, Moggallana, beware. This is a mighty Naga." The elder said, "Venerable Sir, the 4 Iddhipadas have been developed by me, repeatedly practiced, made the vehicle, made the basis, established, consolidated, and properly undertaken. I can tame not only Nandopananda, Venerable Sir, but 100, 1,000, or 100,000 royal Nagas like Nandopananda." The royal Naga thought, "When he went in the first place, I didn't see him, but now when he comes up, I'll catch him between my fangs and I'll chew him up." Then he said, "Venerable Sir, come out. Do not trouble me by walking up and down inside my belly." The elder came out and stood outside. The royal Naga recognized him and blew a blast of fire from his nose. The elder attained 4th jhana, and the blast failed to move even a single hair on his body. The other bhikkhus, it seems, would have been able to perform all of the miracles up until now, but at this point they would not have attained such a rapid response, which is why the Blessed One would not allow them to tame the royal Naga. The royal Naga thought, "I can't even move a single hair on this monk's body with a blast of dragon fire from my nose. He is indeed a mighty and powerful monk." The elder abandoned that form, and having assumed the form of a Supanna, he pursued the royal Naga, demonstrating the Supanna's blast. The royal Naga abandoned that form, and having assumed the form of a young Brahmin, he said, "Venerable Sir, I go for refuge to you," and he paid homage at the elder's feet. The elder said, "The master has come, Nanda. Come, let us go to him." So having tamed the royal Naga and deprived him of his poison, he went with him to the Blessed One's presence. The Naga went to the Buddha and said, "Venerable Sir, I go for refuge to you." The Blessed One said, "May you be happy, royal Naga." Then he went, followed by the Sangha Bhikkhus, to an Atapindika's house for the dana. Remember, this is all, he's on his way to the meal time. No? And Atapindika said, Bhante, why have you come so late? There was a battle between Moggallana and Nandopananda. Who won, Venerable Sir? Who was defeated? Moggallana won. Nanda was defeated. And Atapindika said, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One consent to my providing meals for 7 days in a single series and to my honoring the elder for 7 days. So, there you go. This is the very famous story of Moggallana and Nandopananda, demonstrating the value of rapid adverting to the fourth jhana, right? When you see the dragon's breath coming from, imagine big dragon's nostrils. He'd been walking up and down inside these nostrils, okay? They're not small, right? They're not small nostrils. They're big nostrils. You're standing there, these huge things. They're as big as the entrance to our cave, right? One nostril. And then you see the dragon fire coming out, and you've got to get into fourth jhana really fast, okay? That's the message of this.
Thank you for the page of your eyes, the what?
So many other stories like that. The Visuddhimagga has wonderful stories on psychic powers and so on. So do yourself a favour and
So these aren't legends, then. These really happened.
Really happened. really happened in what sense? Real.
I guess I have to confess to you, but I don't really get some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Like get as in what?
Well, I just don't get the point. I mean, I just don't get the point of all this stuff that, you know, this thing with them. I mean, in Ajahn Mun's story, talks about Ajahn Mun going and doing all these things and talking to this angry Naga, and the Naga never did change, and he keeps tormenting him in the cave and stuff. I don't know, I guess I'm just not that much of that part. I just don't get it.
How do you feel about that?
I just don't get it. I don't understand what the point is. I mean,
getting into the jhana.
But I mean, is that why I want to get into the jhana to do this? I mean,
so you can do it without
attaching some importance to it that I just don't.
But they're blokes, remember, you know. So you got it's just like the kind of Jedi Knight stuff, you know. You got to have some colourful stories and get people excited. Like, wow, you know, now I got battle, yeah. Oh, cool.
So they really. I don't know. This is how they have their fun. I mean.
Yeah. Why not?
So it's a guy thing.
Yeah. I don't know.
We don't hear of any women doing that.
Well, no, we did Sanghamitta. When she was on her way from India to Sri Lanka, the boat was attacked by these Nagas, and she turned herself into a Supanna, into a Garuda, and fought off the Nagas with her psychic powers.
This is commentary, don't forget.
So it's not really. I mean, does anybody else have trouble with it? It's just me.
Yeah.
You do too. Okay.
What about the giant yucca that pissed on the monk at Wakanana Chan? The 60-foot giant yucca.
Yeah.
Recent. No, what was it? Yucca. That was fairly recently.
Mm.
You weren't there for that.
No.
Yeah, something to look forward to. Yeah, keep on practicing.
Isn't it hard enough to overcome? You know, your
kilesas
and stuff.
Yeah. Those stories are bothered. I look at it as an internal thing, those fights within myself with those sorts of things, like I do with the Bible or any of those others, with Bhagavad Gita or
the night and the day.
An inner conflict, not a reality that's happened or on the outside.
It's kind of sweet, though. I mean, kind of the idea, you know, you have these beings which are kind of, you know, fierce and powerful and all these kinds of things, and that even they can be become gentle and sweet and Buddhist and stuff. So that's quite nice.
Well, sometimes they do and sometimes they don't.
Sometimes they say that, but at least they can, yeah.
So is it allegorical, then? I mean, because a lot of indigenous people...
Do you seriously expect to get a straight answer out of me?
Yes, I'd like one, because I haven't gotten one from
Ajahn Yana. Oh, but
Bobby Moses, Ajahn Yana. Yeah, wait till Ajahn Yana comes, yeah.
He'll... Bobby Moses,
Udiyana Mostri, Kasam Nagasori.
My personal feeling is that there are different beings in these different realms. I don't have any problem with believing that these things happen and that many things can happen like that. Whether this actual story happened in this way and whether it was as dramatic and so on as it's talked about, I find it good fun, but I don't particularly have a great deal of huge faith in that story as such. But you know, I think that I don't have any problem with believing that there are different realms of existence and that there are beings who have the kind of different forms and so on in there and that they can interact with the human realm in various ways.
Yeah, I
agree with that. So just to make that distinction, sorry, just to interrupt, but just to make that distinction between believing in these things, you know, can be possible, and then believing in a particular story or, you know, something like that. They're two quite different things.
Because one is really a leap of faith.
Yeah. So, sorry.
You know, I was just thinking about the book about Deepanmal.
Uh-huh.
And have you read that? It's a lovely book, and it just recounts her psychic powers and makes all these stories a lot more believable, I think.
She's not so...
I do believe that she had those powers. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of people alive today who can attest to that. So it takes it out of this Jedi Knight context. Which makes it
I think powers, I can believe people have powers, but walking around in the nostrils of these nagas and things, that somehow it just stretches, it stretches you too much. And
I think that's what the naga felt as well.
It's the tendency of the commentary to proliferate. Like, I remember meeting the minor readings, I think it's translated as this little book that was made for novices. I remember reading that and its commentary. The commentary just went on and on and on before you actually even get to actually what the actual text looks like. It's like this little tiny, like 2 or 3 pages, 4 or 5 pages. And then the book is this thick, the commentary, on a couple of pages, and then it takes forever just to get to the refuges. So it's this tendency. Also, if you look at the Udana and then you look at its commentary, it's like, whoosh, what happened there?
Yeah.
So it's this natural tendency of
proliferation. Yeah. So, but I think it's certainly worthwhile to check out those passages in the Visuddhimagga, especially on the development of samadhi and the development of the psychic powers. It does give some information, which is quite if you're hanging around in Theravadan circles, you know, you hear that kind of language, and the ideas that are talked about are quite commonly used. And so it's good to be familiar with the source text for a lot of those things. And, you know, some of the things I think are quite sensible and useful. And many of the stories are certainly, at the very least, they're entertaining. So. Right, so let's finish up.
Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangham.